Hello, and welcome to a podcast from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2010 Annual Meeting. You can find more podcasts like this on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. Or you can find us on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE. On this podcast, we feature a keynote session from William G. Thomas III, the John and Catherine Engel Professor in the Humanities in the Department of History at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. His session is entitled, Digital Histories for the Digital Age. How do we teach writing now?
One of the things that we would like to experiment with here is that, as you know, the situations in Haiti are quite dire. And as we come to appreciate, I think, as a community, that learning is about community. Learning thrives on community. And community can happen both in instances like this annual meeting when we're here to talk about our mutual challenges and opportunities, but also can mean coming forward and helping those who are in times of distress. So what we've done is set up a wave to initiate a conversation. How can we, the ELI community, perhaps reach out and help the folks in Haiti rebuild their educational system and their classrooms? So as you can see on this screen, if you search in the wave search box with colon public tag colon Haiti, you'll get to the wave. And please jump into the wave and share with the community on things that we can do as a community to help them rebuild their learning infrastructure. I wanted to point out that we have expanded the number of sessions that we're streaming out in real time. Not only the featured and general sessions, but now also a set of the concurrent sessions are going out through Sonic Foundry. And also, we have now, as you can tell in the far corner here, we are joined by colleagues in Second Life, and they will be with us for the general sessions. So I would like to thank these three folks who are instrumental. Without them, this would not be happening. This participation by Second Life in real time, with our annual meeting, would not be possible without the efforts of Tanya, AJ, and Shannon. So my thank you very much to the three of you. Now, we do ask you to be good net citizens. One thing is that if you are not in Second Life here in Austin, we ask you not to go into Second Life. Unfortunately, Second Life soaks up bandwidth like a sponge soaking up water. And if a lot of people try to join in and go to the Penn State Amphitheater, then the bandwidth will kind of slow to a crawl here. So if you're out of world right now, we'd ask you here in Austin to stay out of world for bandwidth considerations. Likewise, if you're here in Austin, there's no need, hopefully, for you to go to catch the Sonic Foundry streams. So please don't pick those up here in Austin. And then there will be bandwidth aplenty for all of us. Now, it's very traditional here to thank everyone who had a hand in this annual meeting. And believe me, this is my first annual meeting from the point of view of an organizer, and you can't believe how many moving parts there are and how many people contribute to make this happen. First and foremost, though, I would like to thank everyone on the program committee. Without their tireless work in terms of guiding us, shaping us, and doing the reading of the proposals, we would not be here at this annual meeting today. Could I have everyone on the program committee stand up and take a bow? Similarly, the ELI Advisory Board is a group of community members who advise us on directions for ELI. And I would also like to acknowledge their contributions because, again, they are also helping to steer the ELI ship in a way that we hope is useful for all of you. So could I ask the members of the ELI Advisory Board, please, to stand up just for a moment. Thank you. And finally, I would like to thank our corporate partners. They've been most generous in coming forward and supporting things like tote bags, refreshment breaks, lunch, and things of that sort. And I would very much like to thank them and acknowledge their contributions to the annual meeting. And this set of names you see on the screen is a most amazing set of people. I have just been amazed at watching these folks at work, pulling off all the logistics and planning for this meeting in order to make it go forward. It's just an amazing amount of work and coordination that they do. So I would also like to have them stand up and us to acknowledge them and their contributions. And thank you, first and foremost, to all of you for coming here. I know some of you have told me you've come here paying out of your own pocket in order to attend ELI. We hope that it meets up to your expectations, and we want to hear from you. So please do fill out your evaluations at the end of the conference so we know how to make improvements and make sure this annual meeting is meeting your expectations. Thank you, all 495 of us. Finally, I'd like to recommend that you save this date on February 14th, 2011, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. Eastern Time, Washington, D.C. Hilton. We will convene this annual meeting in Washington, D.C., and I'm pleased to be able to announce today that our rhetoric speaker will be Professor Eric Mazur, one of our pioneers in our profession. So please mark your calendars, 1 p.m. on February 14th, 2011, for the kickoff of the next annual meeting. As a last housekeeping bit before I introduce our rhetoric speaker for this year, we are, as Veronica mentioned, experimenting with Google Moderator. This is the URL. If you follow this URL and sign in with your Google account, you can contribute questions and vote on the ones in the pool already for the ones that we will be asking Will when he's done with his presentation. And I do have one housekeeping here that for the session for tomorrow, Wednesday at 10 a.m., there's been a slight change. This is a corporate session in Salon D. The title for the session is The Learning Cloud, Learning Productivity, and an Education Assurance Consortium. And it will be moderated and facilitated by Bill Graves. So that's tomorrow, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce to you our Hederick Memorial Speaker. Bob Hederick was a pioneer in the IT profession. He was one of the founding fathers, if you will, of the organization that was known as the National Learning Infrastructure Initiative, or NLII, that was the immediate predecessor of the ELI. So we named this initial keynote of the annual meeting after Bob to acknowledge and honor his contributions to teaching and learning. Often, IT-based innovations in teaching and learning focus on courses in the sciences, where much of the work is quantitative in nature. But in the humanities, whose work is often qualitative, utilizing digital resources for teaching and learning has had its unique challenges and opportunities. Our presenter for the Hederick Lecture has spent much of his academic career meeting those challenges and exploring these opportunities. Will Thomas is the John and Catherine Engel Professor in the Humanities at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Much of his work as an historian focuses on the Civil War era. He has led two pioneering initiatives to make original resources available on the web. First, the Valley of the Shadow, a digital archive of primary sources that document the lives of people in Augusta County, Virginia, and Franklin County, Pennsylvania, during the era of the American Civil War. For that work, he shared the Lincoln Prize in 2001 with his colleagues Ann Rubin and Edward Ayers from the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College, and he was awarded the James Harvey Robinson Prize from the American Historical Association in recognition of the project as an outstanding contribution to the teaching of history. A second project, Race in Place, makes available resources and documents pertaining to racial segregation laws between 1880 and 1950. And writing in an era of digital new media remains a fundamental component of the humanities. The question today is how best to teach this art and to foster the skills of students in the discipline of scholarly writing. Will Thomas will address this topic now, speaking on digital histories for the digital age. How do we teach writing now? Will, thank you very much.
Thank you. Put this over here. Thank you. Welcome and good afternoon. Thank you, Malcolm, for that nice and generous introduction. Thank you, Diana, for inviting me and Julia Little and others who've over the years been supportive and encouraging. It means a great deal. I'm really glad to be here to speak with you today. I especially am glad because I think this conference, the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative Conference, is one of the most important conferences out there in higher education today. I believe this organization is where some of the most important conversations in higher education are taking place. You all are shaping the future of our institutions. You're guiding us as we attempt to restructure our pedagogy and our cyber infrastructure. Nothing could be more important or necessary right now. Now, I want to speak with you from a faculty perspective about my experience teaching with technology. And I certainly hope to inspire you. But at the same time, I hope that we can raise some questions together. The answers that I have are tentative, and I want to stress that. The questions are real and significant, and as a faculty member, I'm living through them and trying to work around some of these big issues. I certainly have not solved the IT Rubik's Cube or even come close to solving the IT Rubik's Cube. I don't know. I could never do the Rubik's Cube. So I'm a poor candidate to solve it before you right now in this moment. But I think we need to, I think it's an apt metaphor. There are a lot of moving parts. And what I'm going to talk with you about today is an experiment in my curriculum and in my pedagogy in which all the moving parts came into play and started to change. Let me start today with a story. In the fall of 2007, I was about to go on a research leave with a fellowship from the American Council of Learned Societies. I had a new digital history project underway on railroads and the making of modern America. I wanted to assemble and digitize sources on this topic, to bring together in a digital archive all sorts of evidence to understand this important social process of the railroads' transformation of American society. The project, I thought, when I started out, would study what I took to be the Internet of the 19th century. And it would use the Internet today to expose the sweeping changes that accompanied it. Railroads made 19th century Americans see their world as smaller, more complex, more intricate, what we sometimes today call flatter. And the railroads and the telegraphs, which accompanied them everywhere they went, the social effects of them were felt everywhere. It's like asking today, what's the social effect of the Internet? Politics, law, environment, culture, music, art, all of these things were part of that transformation that I hoped to get a handle on. My challenge was to find ways to bring together relevant sources from diverse and admittedly huge archival records that railroads produced, and to find or create the tools we need for a new social history of the railroads. Not a business history, but a social history. So I wanted to develop what we might call a hypertextual history, a digital history of one of the central transformations in the American past. And I'd already begun to think about how faculty members might use this project, as they did the Valley Project and as they did Race and Place, how they might use it in their teaching, especially in courses like the U.S. History Survey. But I'd not yet begun to think about what were widely known as Web 2.0 approaches, both to my teaching or to digital history in general. So that fall, I found myself sitting in the audience for our university chancellor's State of the University address. And I was thinking about all the many things I might be doing on the project, all the tasks and jobs that I had in my research and so forth, when the chancellor announced a new initiative to improve writing at the university. Now, when a provost or president puts a major set of internal resources behind a pedagogical initiative, faculty members do, in fact, respond. I was immediately interested and started thinking. My mind raced with the possibilities. I was vaguely thinking already about retooling my U.S. History Survey course. When the chancellor unveiled this competition, my mind began to race through the possibilities. I walked out of the auditorium And I was already putting together in my head a team of people who might join me in this effort. Maybe I could get my friends in computer science who were working on some wiki software that I'd heard about. Maybe I could get my friends in English who teach rhetoric and composition and know much more about writing than I do. Maybe I could arm twist some of my colleagues in history to pilot and test this out. We could address writing in the large lecture history survey courses. And we could introduce various digital technologies to improve writing. Clearly, such an effort would have the potential to reach a large segment of the students. Our survey courses were enormous gateways for many of our students at the University of Nebraska. When I started to inquire about how many students took the history surveys, US, World, and Western Civ, I was staggered to find the scale on which we were teaching these courses, about how many each year came through them. It raised the question, what's happening in these courses? Thousands of students are taking them, and are they writing? What kind of writing are they doing? But as so often happens in responding to a funding call, we sought to address a problem we thought we had, only to find that other more fundamental problems presented themselves, ones we did not know we had. We set out to improve writing in history. We found we needed to improve digital literary skills. I would not be here today were it not for the work of my team. And the story I'm going to tell you is largely that of our intense and rewarding collaboration. But I want to say first and foremost that many of the best experiences in my career have come from fair and equal and open collaboration among a team of colleagues, among faculty, among graduate research assistants, among technology professionals, librarians, all engaged in doing something unexpected, something innovative, something creative. That's what I long for as a faculty member, really. Yes, I do like to go deep as a historian into the archives and come out of the dust and out of the elements and come out with the document that may shape the next generation of scholarship. You know, it's a quest that all historians have. But what I really enjoy as a faculty member is working on a team with colleagues. And so I'm very thankful for these opportunities, and I hope you have them too. And I think one of the great things about EDUCAUSE is it's a conference that encourages that sort of puts all of these professionals together in one room. First, the problem we thought we were fixing: how to write in the digital age, writing digital histories. Here was our initial rationale in our rather breathless grant narrative. Now, you have to take this with a grain of, you know, this is a grant narrative, okay? All right. Quote, students in entry-level courses at large public universities are waiting for a new model of collaboration, of informal learning. They hope to engage with the rich digital media all around them and to participate in these courses more actively. Students expect but often cannot find courses that build digital materials around their increasingly collaborative learning styles. We seek to develop a demonstration curriculum, enriched and supported through our agent modeling technology, where students in these courses work exclusively with digital objects and produce domain-specific reflection, collaborative writing, deep engagement with the subject, and ongoing self-assessment. We'll create a new classroom for large lecture courses where there's less anonymity and more dynamic learning, where students truly participate in a community of scholars. The problem in most large lecture courses is widely recognized. Students are assigned little writing and have few opportunities for engagement with the disciplinary knowledge they will need to be successful. Moreover, course management software only contributes to the distance that students feel from the process of learning in the discipline, since these systems often offer one-way delivery of ever-increasing amounts and kinds of content. There's a significant gap in these courses between content and assessment, between the habits of mind we hope to teach and the activities students perform. What I had in mind was that, you know, another project that I had developed on civil rights television news archives, recovering all these old films from television stations around the country and trying to pull them into one digital archive, television stations are throwing away their films from the 1950s, as hard as that is to believe. So I had developed a project at the University of Virginia to kind of try and recover these and digitize them and put them online, and I used them in my teaching. And I had this vision of if we could have students see the stump speech of John F. Kennedy in 1960 in a little town in Virginia. He came to Virginia, gave this incredible speech that was just his regular stump speech, largely focused on the Cold War. And students could follow that, read that speech, watch the tape, and I had this vision of students building from that document, from that object, in multiple directions, collaboratively researching and writing and doing the work of historians. That this would extend out in multiple directions. Now, our vision was in large part an extension of our longstanding research efforts in digital history, and more broadly in what's called digital humanities. Edward Ayers pointed out in 1999 in The Pasts and Futures of Digital History that, as he put it, quote, as rapid as the changes have been, the actual writing of history has remained virtually untouched and unchanged. New technology has not affected the books and articles that form the foundation of what we teach. That was in 1999. But much of this statement remains true today. Historians continue to write history in books and articles, largely in the same way. But the foundation of what we teach with has shifted. We are indeed teaching with digital objects at the foundation of our courses, like that film of JFK in 1960. More and more historians and faculty are bringing these digital materials into their courses. But we're largely still writing history. When we say, what does history look like? We think it's a book. It's a scholarly article. Ayers went on to call historians to a new form of digital writing. Quote, to imagine forms of narrative on paper that convey the complexity we see in the digital archives. Digital history, he pointed out, could be both a catalyst and a tool in the creation of a more literary kind of history. Now, for years, historians have started to talk about this, about digital history and producing a new kind of writing in history. Robert Darnton, long a leader in the field of digital humanities and past president of the American Historical Association, called for a new age of the book in 1999. He suggested that histories might, instead of using an argument to close a case, they could open up new ways of making sense of the evidence, a new consciousness of the complexities involved in constructing the past. Now, I've tried in several places to define digital history and develop examples of what this scholarship might look like. And recently, I found myself arguing that digital histories help us think differently about how we know what we know about the past. When we digitize a timetable, when we encode a text, a letter, a diary, a newspaper, when we create a database of employees from an original payroll, we work through the partial, you know, the fragmentary, the contingent nature of our history. And we're reminded as well that the people in the past that we study lived complex, meaningful, interconnected lives, not entirely found in the spotty records that remain, the letters, the government reports, the photographs, maps, and books. Indeed, many of these records, especially those of the government or railroad corporations, were created for particular reasons that don't necessarily have much to do with the lives, ambitions, and hopes of the peoples mentioned in them. if we're beginning to write new forms of history, if we're responding to Ayres' call and Darnton's call and others to create new forms of written work in history, shouldn't we expect our students to do the same? To follow our lead? Maybe to produce their analysis in these potentially exciting new formats? Now, the ideas behind the movement in digital history, for me, kind of came into contact with the movement and efforts in digital pedagogy. Marilyn Lombardi has recently pointed out, for example, in several ELI publications, I think ELI is putting out some of the greatest work in this effort for faculty to read. She's recently pointed out the difficulties in teaching survey courses. They're juggernauts, she wrote, with a merciless trajectory. That sounds tough, doesn't it? Who wants to take a course that's a juggernaut with a merciless trajectory? But she's right. She's right. And they depend, she points out, on traditional modes of assessment. Now, there's nothing wrong with traditional modes of assessment, but we ought to be asking ourselves some questions about it. She points out that research studies suggest clearly that content coverage may be less valuable than independent thinking and creativity as a means toward disciplinary understanding. But faculty, she also points out, know how difficult it is to move in this direction. And it really is. It's clear to me, and I'm sure to many of you, that there's going to have to be a great deal of transformative faculty development, that is essential to continue to spur a kind of active learning pedagogy. Other recent studies have pointed out problems that we at first didn't know we had, at least didn't recognize, the problem of digital information overload, of underdeveloped digital literary skills. John Palfrey, one of the conference's featured speakers here, has raised awareness about the ways the digital generation consumes but does not necessarily produce digital media. And similarly, in my field of history, Daisy Martin and Sam Weinberg have indicated the need to support what they call the novice in the archive. We've turned a generation of students loose as novices into a digital archive of enormous complexity, and we expect them to just know how to behave and how to do this work. And so Weinberg and Martin have asked, how do we use new digital technologies, not only to make sources more available, but also to cultivate skills that teach students to read and think about these sources in meaningful ways? I think we have several connected concerns. And as I reflect on the work that I did in a course to introduce writing, these became increasingly apparent. The first concern is sort of a problem of writing. Writing in the digital medium. What are the models for students? Students are writing in Twitter, they're writing in Facebook, they see writing online in Wikipedia. The writing online is largely almost physically confined. So there's a kind of, if I look at the writing that is being done online, I would say three things about it. It's physically confined, it's often first person in its emphasis, and at least in Wikipedia, but across the internet, it's many times relatively anonymous. Many of these forms of writing, as good as they are for what they do, they run counter in their objectives to what we in the humanities want our students to do in our classes. And so let's just take the problem, for example, of an increasingly prevalent genre of digital writing, the comment box. What is the genre of the comment box? It's to say something extreme, you know, it's to phrase something so that it's instantly effective. And longer and sustained commentary and analysis tends to fade away. So I think we have a problem with the kinds of writing that is being done. Second problem is what I would call the problem of provenance. That's a fancy word for where do things come from. You know, we have copies of copies of copies online. And students are faced with a very important fundamental question. What are primary sources? Is what they are looking at a primary source? Now, I won't do this, but I'm very tempted to click on Born in the USA and have a real rock out session here with my hero, Bruce Springsteen. But if you go to YouTube and you click on Born in the USA, you'll see dozens of replications of this important ballad from the mid-1980s. But many of them look like they're created in 2007. You know, they're posted in 2007. It's an object that's copied from something that aired on MTV in the mid-80s. And the same would be true for Michael Jackson and his seminal work on MTV as one of the first black artists on MTV. Well, that's in textbooks, and we teach it in American history. But trying to find those objects so that students can see them in their original form. We might pause and also say that MTV Online does not run in the original form. We all remember sitting around in our dorm rooms in college waiting for the next Billie Jean to come on, you know, and that's the whole point. That was the whole point, was to sit there and wait. but now you just go and you click on it and you get it. Often these objects, I'm using these as extreme examples. The issue is very important for teaching history because students are constantly confronted with copies of digital historical artifacts, and they have trouble discerning what they're looking at and what the provenance of it is. Third, I call this the problem of interfaces. Students are confronted with a whole range of different interfaces that I've done this as well, create for them. My project on railroads and the making of modern America is one interface to a whole set of digital materials. There's the Google Books interface, the Library of Congress interface, the Internet Archive, ProQuest, even the University of Nebraska Libraries interface at first glance looks straightforward, but for students is full of complexity. What is the classic catalog? And how is the classic catalog different from this newfangled thing called Encore? ProQuest is particularly significant. I rely on it a lot in my teaching, but it's never clear to students which databases are selected always. And so they will get returns on searches that include articles from 1876 in the Washington Post alongside dissertation abstracts of dissertations published at the University of Chicago in 2003. They can't quite decipher the difference between those, and the interfaces that we have are often not exactly intuitive for our students. So in the fall of 2008, we planned our effort to run a new class, a new large lecture survey class. We'd run a pilot class, we'd refine our assignments, and we'd use our standard Blackboard system to host a wiki that students would work in. And then in the spring of 2009, our plan was that we would teach the U.S. History Survey course again, but we would use our own specially configured classroom wiki, which I'm going to show you in a second. We had two TAs, we had 160 students. Some of the internal support from the Chancellor's grant that we won supported the TA shifts. We made major changes to the way we taught the course. In particular, we introduced team writing assignments in the wiki format, asking teams in each assignment to use the library databases we were just looking at with primary source documents in them, ProQuest, for example, to research a topic. And then they would collaborate to write a thesis-driven statement of historical significance based on and from those sources. The first wiki project we did was on the Progressive Era. So the topics were like Jane Addams, Hull House, the Russo-Japanese War, other Progressive Era topics. The second was on the rise of the U.S. as a world power, basically 1945 to present topics. Now, one of the first things that happened to me in the course of planning and collaboration to retool the survey course for writing was that all sorts of bigger issues started to come into focus at the same time. What should I do with the 3 hours of lecture class time? Should I teach writing? How much? With what tools? Then other fundamental issues and questions popped into view. What is the value of content coverage? With digital information all over the place online, what do students need me to do? Now, I can tell, by the way, that there are great sessions. There are so many great sessions at this conference. That's one of the difficulties in coming here. You want to go to all of them. There's one, the Southern Pacific University, I think, has got a session on what happens when the three hours of undergraduate lecture course time, that class time, is just reversed, is changed. This is a key question, and I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. But I found myself thinking, what do I do with the 3 hours? What do I do in lecture, in a large lecture with 160 students? In other words, the floodgates opened. To use another metaphor, I felt like I was sailing in the open ocean. I had no landmarks, no buoys, you know, the familiar navigational systems to guide me, no lighthouses. I was going to have to sail by current and wind, and this was clearly going to be what you might call a shakedown cruise. So I decided to make big changes. First, after much hemming and hawing, I dropped the textbook I was using. I wouldn't have a textbook for the course. This was particularly symbolic because for years I had used Ed Ayers's fine textbook called American Passages. He's my friend and my mentor and my advisor. Don't tell him, please, okay? This is a secret between us. We're just going to keep it right here in this room. Oh, and our extended rooms out there. That was a difficult decision. I decided to change some of what I would do in the 3 hours of class time. I'd focus on the significance of events, on explanation, on explaining events. I wouldn't concern myself with how much content I could cover in a 50-minute lecture. I can't tell you how hard that was to make that transition, but I'm going to try here today. Instead, my work would be to model the historical thinking I would want them to bring to their assignments, especially to their work in the wiki. I would not test on identification terms, ID terms. The tests would be essays only, and the essays would ask students to use primary source documents from a reader to formulate a thesis. In essence, the midterm and the final exam would ask them to deploy the skills that they hopefully learned in the process of doing the wiki assignments. Lecture would not be a march through various terms. I took time out of lectures to do full sessions, how-to sessions, how to read a document, how to write a thesis statement, how to analyze sources, how to think about the past. And I gave, if I do say so, inspirational speeches on the way we approach historical events and how in this course they would have the opportunity to be their own historian. And as I talked about what it meant to be your own historian, what kind of critical eye, discerning mind, sensitive heart, dogged determination would be required to be your own historian, not to mention sheer bravery and a sense of humor, that's what was necessary to join our ranks. Who wouldn't want to be their own historian? The more I did this, the more I could feel time ticking away in the course and the content coverage slipping into the background. This produced no small measure of anxiety for me, but it seemed worth it. The focus of the entire enterprise would be on historical thinking above all else, on the habits of mind necessary to do history. So writing would be what they would do to enact doing history, to practice doing history, to see themselves doing history. Our pedagogical approach could be summarized by this slide. It would be an attempt to, in a way, move our research enterprise in digital history, which I've been involved with for some time, much more directly into the classroom. Now, it's important to emphasize here that we did not want to evaluate our specially designed wiki system, which I'm going to show you in a second. We didn't really want to evaluate it against Blackboard. That wasn't the objective. We wanted to evaluate our approach, what you see here. We wanted to evaluate our pedagogical approach. And our specially designed wiki would help us do that. It would do some things that Blackboard couldn't that would allow us to evaluate this approach. We also wanted our pedagogical approach to be used in your systems, to be taken up in Blackboard if necessary, or in a system that you might design for your faculty. As tempting as it was to come, sort of, as I ran through this year, to come back and try and line up, well, did our system perform better than Blackboard's? That eventually I found that wasn't obviously the key issue. The key issue was what could we learn about our pedagogical approach from our system. Now, a shakedown cruise, I should remind you, implies a number of things. Rough weather, seasickness, total chaos, at least once, and hopefully no one dies. As Bob Dylan says, the darkest hour is right before the dawn. So if you do anything like this, bear that in mind. So here's what happened. The objective was historical analysis and thinking. The writing would be the central activity in the course. The technology, our wiki systems, would support this central activity in service of our objective. Now, my friends in computer science were developing this wiki system with multi-agents. Don't ask me to explain the details of multi-agent systems and analysis, please. But this would, as I understood it, allow us to track users better. Each student had an accompanying agent. It would learn over time based on the algorithms that the CS faculty were building into their system. We were deploying this wiki in computer science writing sessions. They were doing that in English and in the big survey course that I was doing in history. The key innovation from their standpoint was that the CS wiki would build groups of students using their special algorithm to enable better learning over time, to give the instructors more capabilities to see and measure student activity. And so we'd try this out in our class. Now, I should say that the writing assignments were carefully, you know, scaffolded and sequenced. We began by helping them become better readers of primary documents, by giving them writing prompts, learning the wiki system based on their reading of primary documents, using questions that historians ask habitually. Who wrote this? What were they writing? Who were they writing to? What did they want? What rhetorical strategies were embedded in this document? Eventually, they would write a thesis statement. They would learn to write a substantial paragraph. The first group wiki assignment was done in Blackboard. The second in our system, which is called Classroom Wiki. Okay? So the first one was in Blackboard. The second one was in Classroom Wiki. Here are the highlights of that experience. I'm not going to put them on the board. This is just between us. Here are the highlights of that experience. The first experience with Blackboard. We found out right away many students had real trouble with the interfaces to the library databases, understanding, as I pointed out, what the digital objects were, despite our how-tos. We found a moderately high level of concern among achieving students, especially highly achieving students, that their group project would affect their grade negatively, or that they would unfairly be burdened with carrying others. I think this is something that we face across the board in collaborative projects. But here it gets interesting. We found that most groups in this first assignment spent time meeting face to face, even though we had expected the groups to work almost entirely asynchronously. They didn't. They did the work offline, then they talked about it, then they met and they juggled schedules, and then they changed and edited it, and then they posted it in the wiki. So they were using cell phones and text messages and IMs and email, and they got themselves worked up into quite a dither. But there was no record of the process of that collaboration in the system. No record of the process of their doing history. Now, partly this was technical. Blackboard's interface didn't really have an easy connection to its forum. But partly this was social. This was social in that what they thought they should be doing. They thought they were doing what they should be doing. And finally, on this first assignment on the Progressive Era, we managed to bring Blackboard to its knees. I am sorry to report that we basically broke it. I think, frankly, the whole system went down at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. In the last 30 minutes of the assignment deadline, as much as half of the class attempted to upload their written work, which they had completed offline. And I learned of this immediately as, as students representing their team began emailing me their projects. Of course, Blackboard had buckled. But, okay, so those are the highlights. For the second group project, we were using our system, this classroom wiki system. And I have to say that this transition was in itself a risk. I mean, we were switching a technology right in the middle of a semester's class with 160 students. Some would call that absolutely foolhardy and insane. And it probably was. But it actually worked out just fine. They had to get, it was a new interface. They had to get a new login. But it seemed worthwhile. I didn't know when I would have another opportunity, really, as a faculty member, to kind of be in this so fully, you know? And so why not do it? I wanted to see what would happen. Here are the highlights of that experience. We gave clear directions about the purpose of the assignment. We gave them more often and more consistently. We told students that the more they engaged and participated online, the higher their scores. We also informed them, and this was true as you'll see, that our new system tracked their work individually in much more detail than Blackboard's. This prompted a fairly significant response, as you can imagine. We immediately saw a more sustained conversation in their forums about sources, about primary sources, about meaning. They were doing history right in front of us in the forums. There was a higher performance overall, but there was in our system the ability to track individual level work at a finer level of granularity. So these, in effect, became collaborative assignments individually assessed with a higher degree of individual accountability. Now, the computer sciences teams, my colleagues' main interest was in the viability of their group formation agents, their algorithms, and whether the group formation, in fact, had any discernible effect on student performance. I simply wanted to know, did they do better on the final exam? And that was a difficult question to get an answer to. But we found that students did slightly but statistically significant better who were in the groups formed by the algorithms. That is, there was a more intentional purpose to the group formation. This year, right now, this semester, I'm deploying this system again, and I'll have a much better set of data and kind of a much better handle on that particular issue. And finally, anecdotally, we saw better final exam essays. I know that's not got hard numbers behind it, but after the second wiki project, I felt, having done this many times, final exam grading, we could literally see the students putting into practice what they had learned through the wiki assignments. Now, the wiki system that we were deploying and developed at the University of Nebraska allowed us a finer granularity I mentioned. And I'm going to show you a few examples of it. It gave us some different ways to see the work as it progressed. And the system's grading and commenting functions were especially useful for our assessments. We found particularly useful the total word counts of individual students. The average was 5,596. The number of days that they logged onto the system and made changes. The average for the second assignment was 6.4 days, but the high was 22 days. Every single day that student engaged in the assignment, made changes, and worked on it. Several students logged on and did their work 18 days out of the 22. But here are some of the ways that we could see. What you're seeing here is student activity across the different types of activity by the control and the treatment group. The control group were students whose groups were formed randomly. The treatment group were students whose groups were formed by the CS algorithm that I was describing earlier. Okay, and so you see a kind of difference. The treatment group earned higher average scores, and we believe it suggests that they were able to work better together. But the total interaction was fairly similar in terms of its overall size. And the treatment group rated their peers slightly better. They had a better working experience, it seems. There's still a great deal to do about this. And I caution that these sorts of evaluations and assessments are very preliminary. But this is the kind of view that we could get out of our wiki system. Student activity counts over time and by area. And we could do this individually as well. Each individual student could be tracked in this way. Here's this first assignment connected to the second assignment in terms of the total activity that students performed. Now, the first part was due on day 9, 9 days to go. You can see that. But you can see that, there's a drop-off, you know, whew, okay, turned in the first part and kind of got that done, and then back at it again. The depth and the size of the second assignment, I think it's pretty clear that there's a substantial difference in their participation. Now, because our system tracked more of the activity than Blackboard did, this is just a comparison of the similar areas that Blackboard and our wiki system could track. But we still see higher interaction and broader plateaus there. Before we look at a little bit of the students' work, this slide, this last sort of data slide, shows an important but cautious correlation. When students were divided into three groups, those who improved, those who did not improve, or those who stayed the same between the midterm and the final, we found that the performance on the second wiki assignment correlated in statistically significant ways. It's significant that these are students, the improvers, from all grade ranges. That is, if they improved from a C minus to a C, or if they improved from a B minus to a B, or from a D to a C, all improvers, in other words, were parts of higher scoring wiki groups. And the relationship is not accidental. This is something that I'm still sort of working through and puzzling through, but I find this encouraging and significant for us. Here's some of the things the students had to say about their experience. It's one thing to read. What you're going to see here is kind of how much they have not done before in this, how much of this was new. Okay, they got to play the part of the historian, develop an opinion about historical events. It was hands-on. I've never been in a class that required me to write historical analyses like this class did. And I felt a little unsure of exactly what was required at first. This trepidation is very significant and important to recognize. Working in a group allowed me to use communication skills. Okay, this was a new experience. Felt like become a better student. Writing quality improved. And finally, on this one, this is, I think, a very fair representation of how students feel. Of course, wasn't what he expected. Expected a standard history class where the information is given, notes are taken, and then the information is given back in a ID or multiple choice test, right? And he didn't like this format, this new format. There's a big nervousness among students about these new kinds of approaches. But I actually grew to like it, and that phrase at the end there about being intimidated, I think, is significant. Let me show you. This is our system, Classroom Wiki's system. Here's the assignment for the U.S. as a world power. So this is a demo. This isn't live. I mean, it is live, but it's not active. So here's the assignment. The students are sort of, as a team, given a particular event, the Bay of Pigs, the Berlin Airlift, and a date. And they're going to use ProQuest and the other sources we have to find primary sources and to do the work of a historian to write up an essay about the historical significance of that. And so here's an example of their activity in the forum. Here's a student doing the kind of work of a historian, gathering together sources, looking through the New York Times, commenting on them, analyzing them. I found as I looked at these, and I know they're small, I guess in the back it's hard to read, but here's the student's historical analysis of one. Race is the most emotional and most dynamic factor in human history. In Asia, patriotism and race were identical. This is why as soon as freedom came to India, it had to be split up. It came to countries, India and Pakistan. It was this sense of race that communist China faced in Asia. Something to note is that the humanitarian Nehru and the Marxist Chow and Lai, who theoretically believe in raceless world but fought for control of Asia through racial emphasis, you know, these kinds of piecing through the fragments of the past, trying to come to terms with the complexity of it, and developing detailed kinds of ever more detailed analytical approaches on this particular subject. This is the Bandung Conference in 1955. Here we see another student's kind of describing whether it's a good idea or not to put the paragraph under the topic page. They're trying to piece through how to write this up. And then this one I think is particularly telling. There are major economic problems that may occur as a product of this conference. Then she quotes from a particular source. To impress Asian neutralism, it must be demonstrated that Seato has probably a value in terms of living standards as well as self-protection. And then she says, I later learned that the Bandung Conference exposed the weak authority of Seato through its lack of local participation and representation. This piecing together of the past is exactly what I want them to be doing. And then to see them take those materials, the analysis, and then write them up into a well-formed, well-argued, cited kind of approach is what I was after. Now, I should say that we've got a great deal of work to do. We expect students to bring in multimedia to this as well. This system handles it, and I think this year we're going to see more of that. Finally, what are the lessons we learned in this endeavor? The first lesson, I would say, is whether or not we used a textbook was less important than we had anticipated. Students were fine without a textbook. I am using his textbook in this semester. I went back to the textbook, but not in the same way. It would be handled differently. More crucial was the hands-on practice we gave students in using the databases to find primary sources. I think the second lesson is that we need better tools for pedagogical applications in the disciplines. Ours was one effort, but we need more innovation in this area. Third, digital literary skills are so important. Students need help deciphering this vast array of materials. And fourth, probably most importantly, I feel like we learned that we could adjust what we do in the classroom in a major way, emphasizing not the acquisition of knowledge, but instead, as I have come to think of it, we are emphasizing the mastery of a process, how to be a historian. The vast changes in our classrooms and in our information technology have led to fundamental questions about higher education and our enterprise. Why go to a residential college when information is available at your fingertips? What will we do with 1 million books digitized online and searchable? What is a lecture course for? And as I struggled to retool my lecture course, these questions lurked. They lingered in the background. My answer to myself was that students need this experience to gain mastery over a process. They should, in these courses, learn to master a process, how to be a historian, how to be a scientist, how to be a sociologist, how to inhabit a major discipline. Mastering a process requires skill development, it requires iteration, it requires student and faculty personal interaction. And mastery, once learned, can be transferred and extended. We teach the introduction to history of the United States not to make sure they know a set of facts, but to teach students the habits of mind and critical inquiry of our discipline. We learned that this could be done not just in a small seminar, but in a large lecture classes, and it needs technology to make it happen. In conclusion, your role is so important. Faculty are looking for guidance. They know that teaching is changing out from under old structures. A single example is Wi-Fi everywhere. We have lit up our campuses like crazy, and the change in the last 5 years is massive. Faculty need and want to consider integrating technology into their teaching, but they want to do so in ways that build up the habits of mind, the critical thinking, and the disciplinary practices that they so highly value and that they wish to impart. This learning can't be easily acquired online. Students know this. That's why they're at our institutions. You are the key players, it seems to me, in navigating these important transformations. Your work as professionals is absolutely essential to the future of higher education. And I wish you well, and I look forward to the rest of this conference and to the questions. Thank you very much.
A session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2010 Annual Meeting. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.